This is RBN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.
Next guest, I hope, is David R. Crow, C-R-O-W-E, and his website is Alberta Reappraising AIDS Society, and we'll have him up momentarily, but there's so much that we've heard for several decades, out AIDS. And of course, many of us know that it was a concocted situation and that there are many questions and things that need to be addressed. And David is going to do that for us now. David, are you with us?
I am. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Thank you so much.
The wonders of technology. I'm pleased to be on your show.
Oh, I'm so happy that you're on my program. One of my listeners said, you have got to have him on your program. And so I immediately contacted you and was so, so grateful when you responded that you would be on the program. And I think it's wonderful that you can join us. Tell us about your... You are the president of this society.
Well, I'm actually the president of two societies. I'm the president of Rethinking AIDS, which is actually a society with its roots in the early 1990s, and also the Alberta Reappraising AIDS Society, which is a much smaller organization and more recent. Rethinking AIDS was started by a group of scientists in 1991. They said, you know, wait a minute, everybody's accepting this HIV equals AIDS hypothesis, but we have some questions. And it wasn't until 1995 that they could get, an article published in a major journal. I forget which scientific journal it was, maybe Lancet, in which they said, you know, there's some open questions about the causation of HIV and AIDS. And really the questions have only grown since then, but the theory has been generating so much money that's just drowned out the few scientists who are brave enough to stick their heads up and say, you know, we never did prove this connection.
Wow. And of course, the situation, but people believe what they are told by allopathic medicine. And of course, I think a lot of times, well, most of the time, that the actual remedy for these so-called diseases, is what actually kills the patient, is the so-called treatment.
Well, they
never say cure, but treatment.
Right. AIDS is the poster child for iatrogenic death, because the major class of drugs for supposedly dealing with HIV is what's called nucleoside analogs. And if you remember high school biology, you know, people learned that DNA is made up of adenosine, cytosine, guanine, and thymidine, the four bases that make up the DNA chains. And the first AIDS drug was known as AZT, and not by coincidence, the T stands for thymidine. So it's a false part of DNA, and one molecule of AZT stops a DNA chain from growing. So you can imagine that if your blood system, for example, which reproduces cells all the time, encountered a molecule of AZT, one blood cell would die. And of course, there's millions or billions of molecules in the daily dose. And even though the drug AZT, which was approved in 1987, is not really used that much anymore, it still has some uses. It's been replaced by other drugs in the same class, the nucleoside analog class, And that really has to be probably the most dangerous class of drugs known to man, when people are supposed to take them for a lifetime.
Wow. Well, lifetime, that's a lot of money for Big Pharma.
Well, yes. Funny you mentioned money. The newer drug combinations, because nobody takes one drug anymore. That's not cool. They usually take three or four drugs, although they're often put into a pill, a single pill, which also helps a drug company maintain market share because they can put their three favorite drugs into one pill, and then you really don't have a choice of which drugs to use. But the newer drug combinations cost over $30,000 a year. And that's only one of the costs of being an AIDS patient, because the drugs are toxic to your liver and to your kidney, to your blood. You're always having tests done, and you're probably going to be put on other medications to deal with some of the side effects or to perhaps protect you for things that they think are going to happen to you. And so, you know, polypharmacy is big in AIDS. Yeah, even in some cases, it's only one pill, but it actually has three drugs in it.
Wow. I remember that I had a friend, when I first became aware of this situation, I had a friend that had received a blood transfusion. And, he was really very ill. He had all kinds of different things that happened to him, all kinds of illnesses. They couldn't figure out what was wrong with him. And, he ultimately and pretty quickly passed away, and then they diagnosed him as having AIDS. And of course it was traumatic for his family, and it was it kind of put a cast a shadow on the family, because AIDS is associated with homosexuality in many cases. And at this point in time, in 1987, I believe it was, when he passed away, the family was kind of ostracized. It was just a terrible thing.
That's the second time that 1987 has been mentioned. I mentioned it as the year that AZT was approved for use. Many people actually got AZT in the clinical trials, so they may have had it in maybe 1986. But in 1987, it was pushed very hard, and that's when the high death rate amongst hemophiliacs, for example, started, was after they were all put on AZT, or almost all of them. I know one hemophiliac who was not put on AZT in 1987 and has never taken AIDS drugs for a day, and he remains healthy to this day with hemophilia. His only health problem is under control. But he said that most of the people he knew, and of course hemophiliacs tend to go to hemophilia clinics, so they get to know each other. He said they're all dead now.
Wow.
Died pretty soon. I mean, AZT was given in extremely high doses, and over time they backed off on the doses. I think the highest dose was 1.5 grams. Of active ingredient per day. And now that's, if they include AZT in the combination, it's probably down to 0.2 grams. So what is that? That's like a seven times the dose, one-seventh the dose that it used to be. And thus the drugs are a lot less toxic, but they still are toxic. And if you read the label, they can cause just about any side effect under the sun. Yeah, particularly organ failure.
Oh my gosh. And that's true of most drugs. If you listen to the advertisements on TV, and our country, and I believe New Zealand is the only two countries in the world that allow direct marketing to the public, by Big Pharma. And as you're looking at these wonderful pictures of people laughing and their hair flowing in the wind and having this great time, they're telling you about all the side effects, which are pretty bad.
But I think most people kind of think that if they advertise it on television and it's basically approved by the government, it really can't be that bad. And it's just a bunch of lawyers have said, you know, you gotta deal with the fine print. But actually, if you read the scientific literature, there's, you know, just, I know AIDS better than many other diseases, but the literature is full of case studies of people who had severe illnesses after starting the drugs. There's a ton of evidence that drugs are highly toxic. AZT was particularly toxic to the blood system, and scientific journals used to have glossy ads for a product that I cannot remember the name of, but it's a blood stimulator. And it actually said, this combination is very useful for your patients on AZT. So they were advertising knowing that AZT caused severe anemia. They would give you this blood stimulator, which would help you stay alive a little bit longer. That's just one of the serious side effects of these drugs. But the bad science goes a lot deeper. You can't deny that cancer exists. Although there is a lot of overdiagnosis of cancer, there's no question that some people have cancerous tumors, and you can't say that the whole thing is a fraud. The treatments might be a fraud, but
yes,
there are cancers. But that might not be true of HIV.
But if you read books like Screening for Cancer, and they send out these life screening, I can't remember what company, Lifeline screening. They want to screen you for everything because they are attempting to find something to treat. Everyone has cancer cells in their body. It doesn't mean that you have cancer.
I agree.
Yeah.
I'm not disagreeing. I know there's a huge amount of overdiagnosis. I just interviewed Dick Ablin, who invented the PSA test and is an advocate against using his own test because he says it is not a test for cancer. There's a huge amount of overdiagnosis of breast cancer and prostate cancer.
Absolutely.
But there are some people who do have life-threatening cancers. The question with HIV that has arisen, probably starting in the early 90s, is whether the virus actually even exists. And there are more and more scientists who have questioned a lot about HIV and AIDS, who have not just started, but have for a couple of decades, questioned whether the virus exists. It's never been purified. Without purification of a virus, you cannot develop a test. You can't do anything. You will find in scientific articles about HIV, people will talk about isolating the virus, but the virologists have debased isolation to the point that it doesn't mean anything. For example, if you have a cell culture and some of the cells start dying, that could be caused isolation of a virus. If you see certain chemicals in this soup, which is certain cells plus chemicals plus biological components plus maybe some blood from a person who might have a virus, they can look at the presence of certain chemicals, certain enzymes, cell death. Many things can be called isolation, but it's never actually purification of the virus. The word isolation means to separate one thing from another, but virologists got away for decades with using this word to mean whatever they want it to mean. It's like Alice in Wonderland.
Wow. Now, when you first came on today's program, you said that you have two websites. One is the ARAS, ARAS.AB.CA.
And the second one is RethinkingAIDS.com.
Okay. RethinkingAIDS.com. I want to make sure I have that. Yes, it was always something scary when they introduced it or when they start talking about it. I think that it was frightening for a lot of people. hemophiliacs and people who went to bathhouses and that kind of a thing. If it's something that doesn't exist.
Yeah, well, that's a good question. What's going on? Like, I often get this. I'm a bit
nervous
to answer it now. Like, people would say, I'd say HIV probably doesn't exist. And they'd say, well, what about all those people dying in Africa? You know, what about all those gay men who died? Well, let's go back to 1981 where there was a paper published. Six people who had, I think they all had PCP pneumonia. Back in 1981, there were two diseases called AIDS. Kaposi sarcoma, which is a skin disorder, which may or may not be a cancer. There's debate over that.
Mm-hmm.
And PCP is a serious type of pneumonia. All six of these original patients, and it says it right in the article, were heavy users of paupers, which are inhalant drugs that are marketed almost exclusively to gay men.
Oh.
So paupers are one of the threads of evidence. So despite the fact that all of these six men were heavy paupers users, and none of them had any connection with each other, which would go against this being sexually transmitted, they were looking for an infection. They weren't looking for any other explanation. So they pushed aside anybody who wanted to investigate paupers, and they hung on to the infectious theory. And then they started to medicate gay men.
Oh.
And they went up. And in 1987, they approved AZT, and the death rate continued to go up. Then in the early 1990s, they started to reduce the dose of drugs, and the death rate started to go down. But it's still much higher. It was, zero in 1980. So now I think it's around 20,000 a year. So the death rate of AIDS in America is vastly higher than it was before this whole thing started. And people are taking toxic medications, less toxic than in the 1980s, but still highly toxic. And they are dying of things like liver failure and kidney failure, or their blood system just gives out.
Wow, that's pretty sad.
But if you go to other countries, you run into the problem of the word AIDS. And I think it's really important when you're dealing with HIV and AIDS, with a lot of diseases, to really think about the words that are being used. Because AIDS in 1981 was two diseases entirely in drug-using gay men. That's a subset of gay men, heavy drug users. In 1987, they'd expanded the definition to 30 different, mostly infections, but also some cancers. In 1993, the United States expanded the definition. They added a couple more diseases, but they allowed a low CD4 cell count. That's a type of immune cell. They allowed a low count to result in a diagnosis of AIDS without any AIDS-defining illnesses. So in 1993, healthy people could be diagnosed with AIDS, which meant that you could get on the drugs. That would expand the number of drug consumers dramatically. No other country in the world did that. In Africa, a lot of the diagnosis of a lot of these diseases was too expensive. So they came up in 1986, I think, with the Bangui definition, and you needed three symptoms for the Bangui definition, without even an HIV antibody test, things like persistent fever, persistent cough, significant weight loss, itchy rash. There were a number of them. But basically, the symptoms of malnutrition were redefined as AIDS. And all the money was coming in for AIDS. And so all of a sudden, everybody in Africa was dying of AIDS. In many cases, they didn't even have an HIV test. And even when they do, they don't use the same standards for HIV testing as they do in the Western world.
All righty. We will be right back after from our sponsors. And our guest the last 2 hours today is David R. Crowe. That's C-R-O-W-E. He is the president of the Alberta Reappraising AIDS Society, and that is ARAS.AB.CA. And he's also the president of RethinkingAIDS.com. Now, I think you could compare what you're saying or what you said with the idea that just about anybody that that dies of a respiratory situation in a hospital or elsewhere is said to have the flu. And I believe that they're doing this or making these claims so that they can say, oh, all these people died of the flu. You better run out and get your flu shot. And so they said that there were, what was it, 60 million flu shots were given, and you say, God, 60 million times however much it cost. That's a lot of money for big pharma.
Yeah, and I think that the justification isn't so much that the flu shot is terribly great, because it's not, but these people have convinced themselves that there's going to be another pandemic, and therefore they have to have the capacity to provide in the United States something like 300 million flu shots so that everybody could get vaccinated if it became a pandemic. I remember the swine flu supposed epidemic, which was a disaster. They predicted that it was going to be an epidemic in the spring on the basis of, I think, one soldier who died after heavy exercise. They vaccinated a lot of people, several millions, but only a small fraction of the United States population, because they didn't have the capacity to produce enough vaccine. And the people who got vaccinated tended to be the healthier people, whereas they were most worried about older people and young people, pregnant women, etc. And then there wasn't another single case of the swine flu, and given that the vast majority of people hadn't been vaccinated. But there were about, I think, 1,000 cases of Guillain-Barré syndrome, which is paralysis caused by the vaccine.
Right. The vaccine caused more problems than the, I would rather get the flu than have a flu shot, for Pete's sake.
Well, yeah, most flu shots do contain mercury. The Cochrane group, which is, you know, one of the most respected insider groups, it's a mainstream medical group that is, focuses on evidence-based medicine. It's having its own troubles right now, but it has really tried to keep financial influences out of its decisions. They've analyzed the flu vaccine, the trials about the flu vaccine, and they're very negative about it. They say it has very little benefit and that most of the trials are not well designed. So even the mainstream medical community, if you actually look at the best evidence, is not very happy. But you don't need very good evidence to get something approved. As I said, I was recently talking to Professor Dick Ablin, who invented the PSA test, and in 2014 wrote a book saying you should not get the PSA test because it is not a test for cancer. I was looking for a test for cancer. I didn't find one, but somebody decided that they would get it approved at the FDA as a test to detect cancer. They got it approved, and now we have Movember. We have all these men getting their PSA tested. Cannot detect cancer. It's
amazing.
It's tragic. There's so many of these tragedies, but I think HIV and AIDS perhaps is the biggest, the biggest of these tragedies, because it's so absolute in so many different ways. I mean, there's questions whether, as I said, HIV even exists. You're people talk about AIDS around the world, and yet what I was talking about before the break is that we have the 1981 definition of two diseases, the 1987 definition of 30 diseases, the 1993 definition of 30 diseases or no disease at all, and then we have the African definition, which is very common symptoms of somebody who is malnourished or has an infection of intestinal worms, or is, you know, has malaria or tuberculosis or something like that. So there's a lot of changing of diagnosis from whatever the actual cause is over to HIV. But people talk about AIDS as if it was this one thing, but it's not. If you look at the definitions, I live in Canada, and the per capita rate of HIV in Canada is 5 to 10 times lower than in the United States. We still have a largely undefended border. There's a huge amount of traffic between Canada and the United States. Why would the rate of HIV not have equalized if it was an infectious disease? It makes no sense. But in Canada, they don't have the definition of AIDS that allows a diagnosis of AIDS without an illness on the basis of the CD4 cell count. And the CD4 cell count by itself is another disastrous marker. The CD4 count has been known for quite a long time. It was examined before the era of AIDS. So within the little box of HIV and AIDS, your CD4 count is everything. If your CD4 count is below 500, you're in the danger zone. If it's below 200 or 100, whatever number they want to use, your immune system has crashed. And you'll often read in the newspapers or magazines or online that some person's immune system crashed. You have to understand that that doesn't mean that they were actually getting any infections that you would expect if they had a crashed immune system. What it means is they had a low laboratory number. Well, what do we know about CD4 counts outside of the context of HIV and AIDS? Well, we know that cigarette smoking makes your CD4 counts go up. So if a higher CD4 count is good, then cigarette smoking must be good for you. We know that strenuous exercise makes your CD4 counts go down, so therefore exercise must be bad. We also know that there are a small percentage of people, of healthy people who are not HIV positive, who have such low CD4 counts that if they were HIV positive, they'd be classified as AIDS in America. But if you don't have HIV, your CD4 count is never taken seriously. It's not part of a normal checkup. Doctors don't look at it and say, your CD4 count is 100, your immune system is crashed, despite the fact that you have no infections, we need to do something about this. But if you're HIV positive and you walk in with a CD4 count of 100, the alarm bells will go off and you'll be put on the strongest medicine that they have. And if you start to get sick, but your CD4 counts go up, they will say, look, the drugs are working. There was actually an article published, I think about 10 years ago now, by a doctor in the New York Times, and he described one of his patients. He said, this man who's come into my office, his genes don't fit anymore. He's so thin. He has a big lump on his back. His face is lined. That's all the side effects of the drugs. He admitted it. He said, but he is one of our successes because his viral load, which is another number, a laboratory marker that's used, his viral load has disappeared. Therefore, he has no virus in his body, but we're killing him with the drugs.
Yes.
But the doctor couldn't actually see the irony of what he was doing, that he was actually poisoning this patient. The patient who had bought into the propaganda so well kept going back to him, getting sicker and sicker, and believing that the doctor was helping him.
Wow. That just shows exactly how intimidated by authority people are or have become, that even though they feel terrible, they keep submitting their bodies to the same kind of thing. When something doesn't work, then you do something else.
Yes. I mean, I read something by somebody who was a proponent of the flu shot who said, I get the flu every year, so I have to have my flu shot. But it's like, if you unwind it, it's like, have you been getting the flu shot every year? How many years have you been getting did you start to get the flu after the flu shot? Because people in their mind believe their propaganda. They have the flu shot. They get sick. They say it's the flu. Maybe I didn't get it soon enough. Next year I'll get the flu shot earlier in the season, something like that.
Right.
And they think, okay, I'm still getting sick with the flu shot, but I must be as susceptible. So if I didn't get the flu shot, I'd be even sicker.
Right.
But I've never had the flu shot and never will. And, I guess I've had something that might be the flu a few times, but not very often. The CDC, and I know I didn't come on here to talk about flu, but they published a paper saying that only a small percentage of flu-like symptoms are actually caused by the influenza virus. It's something around 20%, a minority. So that would mean that the flu shot, if it worked 100%, could only protect you from, say, 20% of the actual flu-like illnesses. But they market it as if it protected you against all of them. And how many people, when they have the, quote, flu, actually go to the doctor and actually have any kind of viral test to determine whether it's actually influenza or some other virus, as they say, or something else entirely?
Right. Now, you used the term previously, evidence-based medicine. And I don't think that allopathic medicine that has supposedly been tested, and keep in mind that the companies that submit their claims to the FDA for approval pay the FDA to approve those solutions, the medications that they've created, whether
yes.
they work or not. So they don't actually present any evidence. They just present what they want the FDA to approve. And, it's just very disturbing.
Yeah. I mean,
that people believe that all these things have been tested and have been found to be valid when in fact they haven't been.
Right. I mean, some people see medicine politically and they think that, either the left or the right is better on medicine. This idea of having the drug companies pay for the approval of their drugs, that was kind of a libertarian approach. You know, if you're going to get a service from the government, you should pay for it. So if drug companies want a drug approved, they should pay for it. But what they didn't realize is that they're setting up a pay-for-play system.
Right.
So if you pay the FDA, you expect service. It'd be kind of like, you know, the government says, now you have a special tax to pay for roads, and then 10 years later, they haven't built any roads, and you say, I'm paying you all this money, and you're not building roads. And they say, well, we looked at it, and we decided you don't need a road. So it's very rare that the FDA looks at the evidence they've received along with the check and say, oh, well, this can't be approved. There's some
right. Take your check. We're not going to approve it.
We're just going to take your money.
That.
Right. It'd be like going to the grocery store and you give them the money for your groceries and they say, well, you're overweight, so we're not actually going to give you any groceries, but
right.
we'll take your money. We're not giving you your money back.
Right.
I mentioned Dick Ablin and the PSA test, which was approved by the FDA, which should never have been approved. I also have recently on my show interviewed Remington Nevin, who's a scientific critic of the malaria drug mefloquine that was heavily used by the U.S. military and many other militaries around the world. And he was incensed recently because the FDA, knowing all the problems with mefloquine, which include permanent side effects such as psychosis, in other words, the drug never leaves your body once it's in there, they approved another drug in the same class. Even though the problems with this new drug are the same as the old drug, the FDA they talk about captive agencies, and I think the FDA is completely captive. And yet we all, I guess, present company accepted. So many people are drinking the Kool-Aid that the miracles of modern medicine, isn't it wonderful? The FDA keeps us safe, just like the CDC and the EPA and all those other three-letter agencies. But that's not really their motivation.
They were designed to benefit the corporations, and that's what they've been doing ever since their creation.
Yeah, I
when you look at the revolving door between corporate America and those agencies, you see the kind of influence those agencies have, because they just, the revolving door, you go from one corporation back into the EPA or the CDC or the Food and Drug Administration, and it's obscene.
Honestly. It's everywhere. I interviewed a guy, who was a beekeeper, and he was advocating against the neonicotinoid pesticides that are especially dangerous to bees, right?
Right.
And he said the same thing about the, his USDA, U.S. Department of Agriculture. He said, the purpose of the U.S. Department of Agriculture is to get the products of the big agrochemical companies like Monsanto into use, and it is not to support the farmers. So when a problem happens, like it turns out that one of the newer pesticides is actually causing big problems, the USDA is totally on side with the big corporations, and they're not so interested with the farmers. I mean, I guess at some point, the whole thing has to break. You can't drive every farmer into bankruptcy. You can't kill all the bees. Eventually, stuff happens, but it happens much, much later than it would if it was truly looking out for the consumer or looking out for the farmer or the people that it's supposed to be looking out for.
Right. Well, the hive failure among bees is very critical. And the abatement, the mosquito abatement that they have in so many communities where they're going through the communities and spraying with this poison, that poison affects the entire environment, not just it's not just for the mosquitoes. It's not going to kill just the mosquitoes. It's going to kill all the insects, the butterflies. It'll kill birds. It'll kill bees.
What was the CDC originally? The CDC was originally a mosquito spraying organization.
Wow.
I think around World War II, whenever it started, I didn't believe it when somebody told me this, but I researched it, and they were the Centers for Disease Control. Mosquitoes were blamed for a lot of diseases, so if you kill mosquitoes with DDT or whatever else was being used back then clearly you're going to make America healthier. It's not worked out so well, but they still go back to hating mosquitoes. West Nile virus and Zika, they believe, are spread by mosquitoes.
Ridiculous, ridiculous. And they spray in one country, and the next country, they don't spray. Well, how do the mosquitoes know where the boundary for the country is? It's so ridiculous. If people use their mind and figure this out, they've got to think, well, if it's killing mosquitoes, and it's going to kill everything, and the mosquitoes aren't going to recognize state boundaries or city boundaries, that stuff's going to go all over. And if certain people with respiratory issues are told in my village, we're told, shut your doors and your windows, so that you can avoid any problem with the spraying. Well, my gosh, if it's dangerous for people with respiratory issues, it must be dangerous for all the little animals out there. And this is dangerous stuff. Just to avoid getting mosquito bites. And I called the village, and I also called the people that were manufacturing the spray, and I talked to them about it. And I said, well, how many people have actually died from the West Nile virus as a result of having mosquito bite? Well, they really can't even tell you that.
No, they can't.
Nobody.
Yeah, I investigated the West Nile virus quite intensively back around 2000. The first so-called epidemic in North America was in 1999 in New York City. And I wanted to investigate the evidence that the West Nile virus actually existed. I had read some of the analysis of HIV by a group of Australian scientists known as the Perth Group. So I tried to apply the same analysis to West Nile virus. And, basically what they did to, quote, isolate the virus is, I may have got it slightly wrong because it's a long time ago, but they took mosquitoes, they used the fancy word triturate, which basically means to grind them up. And then I think they inject this material into the brain of another animal, and then they see if that animal gets sick. And that's considered isolation of the virus. What was interesting about West Nile is it always attacked urban areas. I did a map of where the cases were in Canada because they said which town the cases occurred in. And they were all strung along Canada's biggest highway, the 401, which goes between between east and west from Toronto. I used to live in the northern part of Ontario where relatively few people live, and I can tell you that we have more mosquitoes per square mile than the entire industrialized part of Ontario. And there were no cases of West Nile virus up there, even though you can't go outside for about 4 months of the year without getting bitten by a mosquito. You're lucky if you just get bitten by one. You probably get bitten by 100. So why were people not getting West Nile virus in these rural areas? Why was it all in urban areas where there were high levels of air pollution? And it seemed to occur during high temperatures where the air pollution is more dangerous, more toxic, and also people are dealing with heat stress. And many of the victims who died of so-called West Nile virus were elderly people, often on cancer therapy, things like that. But that was never considered a part of the reason why they got sick. They could detect West Nile virus, then ka-ching, our viral theory just became more valuable.
Right. Well, it's just like they were talking about Ebola a couple of years ago. And if you had diarrhea of any kind from any source, then all of a sudden it was Ebola. And they were actually isolating people just because they had diarrhea. My gosh. Yes, if you went to the doctor with diarrhea, you had Ebola.
I actually may have written the only scientific paper that criticized the Ebola vaccine. It was published, I think, in the American Journal of Immunology. And one of the most striking conclusions that I reached was, first of all, the Ebola is no longer a hemorrhagic fever. The CDC definition of Ebola basically means if you have a headache or a fever or anything like that, you can be diagnosed with Ebola if you have two other conditions. One is a positive Ebola test, and the other is contact with somebody who has had Ebola. So what this does is it creates the illusion that it's an infectious disease because nurses are getting diagnosed with Ebola because they had contact with an Ebola patient, they had a headache, and they tested positive on an Ebola test. But you might say, well, they had to test positive on the Ebola test, so how good are the Ebola tests? Well, in one study of Ebola tests that was done in Africa, they had false positive rates in areas where there was no Ebola epidemic up to 20%. So 20% of random people in those areas, random healthy people, would test positive on the Ebola test. So you have a headache, which is a very common, or a fever, which is a very common event, and you've got a 20% chance of testing positive on the Ebola test, and you're a nurse or a doctor or an orderly, or you're a friend of somebody who had Ebola, bingo, you have an Ebola test. But what I also found that is maybe even more interesting is that they listed the side effects of the vaccine that they were testing. And they admitted that the side effects included headache, fever, things like that. And there were like 10 diagnostic criteria for Ebola and like 10 major side effects from the vaccine. And there was almost a complete overlap. It was like 8 of them were in common. So how do you tell the difference in the test in this trial between somebody who has Ebola and somebody who has a headache from the vaccine or a fever?
Right.
So it was the most incredibly shoddy science, and I think they basically were able to manipulate the science so that they could claim that the vaccine was really great, but there were so many flaws with the trial that's completely unsustainable.
But of course they sold a lot of the vaccines.
Yeah.
Out of fear. It's fear-based propaganda, and it's terrible.
Right. And you have these bureaucratic things. Like if The World Health Organization declares that there is a deadly epidemic. They have a particular term that they use.
Mm-hmm.
Then you can use experimental medications. So the World Health Organization declared that it was a serious epidemic. And bingo, now you can test your experimental drugs and experimental vaccines, which you couldn't do prior to this, you know, or it would be much more difficult to do it. So basically, by the World Health Organization doing its piece, then the big pharmaceutical companies can come in with their drugs and vaccines, run really shoddy, quick trials under this emergency situation, get a couple of papers published saying that their drugs or vaccines are wonderful, and then they can hopefully have another epidemic and make a lot of money.
Wow. But then you have to ask yourself, who runs the World Health Organization? What money is behind that? And
I think there's a lot of pharmaceutical money behind it, the same revolving door, and people who sort of grow up in the groupthink that what we need in the third world is more vaccines.
Right.
We need more free cheap AIDS drugs.
Sure. Well, that's what Bill Gates says to reduce the population.
Well, Bill Gates is very useful because he has no scientific knowledge. He has a lot of money, and he's easy to be flattered by saying you are going to save millions of lives. And they can cook the numbers, and they can come back and say, you know, here's our annual report. This year, your foundation saved X million. They can make up whatever the money they wanted. I saw that Zuckerberg said that him and his wife are now going to have a foundation. They're competing with Bill Gates now. And they're going to cure all childhood diseases.
Which oh, wow.
Is not
That's
even,
wonderful.
Which is
Gosh.
Not even a little bit arrogant. That with money, as a billionaire, if I throw that money in the right places, then I can cure diseases. But you might have to think, like, is the disease model that we're pushing?
Right. Okay, we are going to a quick 3-minute break. We'll pick this up on the other side. Be right
okay.
back. Welcome back. This is Deanna and our guest. The last 2 hours today is David R. Crowe, and he is the president of the Alberta Reappraising AIDS Society. That's ARAS.AB.CA, and also RethinkingAIDS.com. But let me share just one little comment from the chat room, which I think is also relevant. The birds and the bees have a very sensitive navigation system that is overpowered and swamped by the electromagnetic smog created by cell phone towers. They should be banned now, and all the people with cell phones will have to go back to the way things were before the late 1990s.
I have to confess that I have a major conflict of interest because my day job is working in the cell phone industry, so I'll have to take a pass because I don't think my opinion would could be taken without considering my conflicts of interest.
Okay. Well, I think anybody that has a cell phone that uses a cell phone, I have one, but I don't. I use it just for emergency purposes. But we were talking about the World Health Organization.
Mm.
And George H.W. Bush was in Congress from January 3rd, 1967 to January 3rd, 1971. And he originated a legislative investigation of world overpopulation. And he managed to get a $10 million grant from the Congressional House Subcommittee on Appropriations to develop a biological weapon through House Bill 15090. And so this money, was then given to the Department of Defense, and they use the World Health Organization to implement several programs. They looked at the census, the worldwide census. He recommended the acceleration of contraception. He advocated that the World Health Organization should implement their international programs, such as inoculations, and leading World Health Organization scientists, as noted in the bulletin of the World Health Organization, had requested that scientists create viruses in order to study their effects on humans. And so now the Department of Defense has this $10 million that it intended to use for studies on immune system destroying agents for biological warfare. And in conjunction with AIDS, I think we're all familiar with Dr. Robert Strecker, correct?
Yes.
And the Strecker Memorandum?
I'm familiar with all that. I mean, my challenge to HIV and AIDS is more fundamental in that I don't believe that the U.S. military, if you gave them $10 billion or $10 trillion, could produce a deadly virus, because I've concluded in my research that viruses don't exist.
Right.
And so I think that, I mean, I had a debate once with a guy, I can't remember his name, sadly he passed away shortly after that, but he was saying that,
Oh goodness, we're at the top of the hour. Okay, we'll pick this up on the other side. Don't let me forget now what you were saying.
Okay,
we'll be right back.
Okay.
Listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network, because you can handle the truth.
Welcome back. This is Deanna, and our guest the last 2 hours today is David R. Crow. He is the president of the Alberta Reappraising AIDS Society, and that website is aras.ab.ca and rethinkingaids.com. Okay, so we were talking about viruses.
Yes, so I looked up his name. Boyd Graves was his name, and he believed that there was a U.S. government program, and I believe there was. I don't know if it was a bit ambiguous whether it was intended to create viruses that could be used as weapons. I don't know. But my analysis is that they can't even prove that the influenza is actually viral. In the 1800s, a scientist named Robert Koch, who is credited with discovering the bacteria that's blamed on tuberculosis, although tuberculosis is also an environmental disease in that it's found commonly in people who live in poverty, miners, and other people who have challenges to their lungs. He came up with what are now known as Koch's postulates, and he said, if you're going to claim that a pathogen such as a bacteria or a virus causes a disease, then you have to satisfy these logical postulates. They're not scientific, they're logical. The first is you have to purify the pathogen. You have to inject it into a susceptible animal. You have to produce the symptoms of the illness, and you have to purify it again. And so one can see that if you could fulfill Koch's postulates, then you've proven that the bug is the cause of the disease. So you purify HIV, Now, it would be unethical to inject pure HIV into a human, obviously, but let's say you injected it into a chimpanzee. The chimpanzee came down with, say, Kaposi's sarcoma or PCP pneumonia. You purify HIV out of this chimpanzee who previously did not have HIV, and you've pretty much proved that HIV is the cause. The problem with Koch's postulates and all viral diseases, they can't get to square one, which is that they can't actually purify the virus. So they try very hard to get around that by using, as I said, they use the word isolation, which basically means nothing when it comes out of the mouth of a virologist, but they cannot purify these viruses. And my conclusion after years is that these are environmental diseases. They're not infectious diseases. Go back to polio, for example. It's clearly an environmental disease. AIDS is caused by many different things, but one of the causes was the paupers that gay men used, blood transfusions, injection drugs. There was actually a very high rate of HIV amongst people who used cocaine, but they didn't inject it. They snorted it or took it in other ways, but they still had a high rate of HIV antibodies.
The only people who actually got polio were the people who got the vaccine.
Well,
now you can get polio by drinking sewer water.
I can't really be true because the vaccine didn't come out until I think 1955, and there was a huge polio epidemic in 1952.
Right.
But the most striking thing about polio is that it had a season. The season of polio was late summer to early fall.
Right.
So it varied around the world, but it might be July, August, September, October. There was a paper in the 1930s, of which I have a copy, which superimposed the fruit harvest season on top of the polio season, and there's a perfect match. So some people think, and people were writing about this in the 1950s, didn't get much attention, that pesticide residues on fruit were the cause of this paralysis. And
wow.
It's not really surprising that you could get paralyzed by a pesticide. Prior to World War II, most pesticides contained arsenic.
Right.
And after World War II, we had things like DDT. And although some people say DDT is not toxic, that's just not true. There was lots written about the toxicity. It might not be toxic under certain conditions. But all of these pesticides have a great deal of toxicity. There was a time, I think in the 1930s, where fruit from Canada couldn't be imported into the United States because it was so contaminated with pesticides.
Wow.
And yet we believe that polio, is infectious. We believe that the vaccine cured polio, but just looking at the timeline shows that that's false. We have this huge epidemic in 1952. The field trial, I believe, was 1954, but only about a million people were vaccinated, so it couldn't have had any significant impact. There was a rise in the number of cases in 1958 and 59 after the polio field vaccine really started to be distributed widely.
Mm-hmm.
And I found a paper in the Journal of the American Medical Association complaining that by 1960, less than half the vulnerable populations had been vaccinated with the polio vaccine. So certainly didn't have a herd immunity by 1960. And yet by 1960, the epidemic was about 5% of what it was in 1952. So the epidemic had disappeared. The vaccine could not have been the cause of the vast majority of the disappearance. And yet it was credited with 100% of the disappearance, even the disappearance that occurred before the vaccine even existed, like
right.
In 1953.
Amazing.
Yes.
Well, apparently in India, there were a big, Bill Gates had a big vaccination program, polio vaccination program there, and 47,000 children developed polio as a result of the vaccines that they received.
The World Health Organization has a very obscure portion of its website on an illness called acute flaccid paralysis. And I think this is very similar. It's a very similar word and a very similar disease to what the CDC is getting all excited about now, which I think is acute myelitis or something, children who are getting paralyzed. Well, in 1996, I think there were something like 10,000 cases of acute flaccid paralysis documented around the world by the World Health Organization. The symptoms are identical to polio. The only reason it's not called polio is they can't find the virus. By around 2011, the number of cases per annum were about 100,000. So we have this strange situation where the World Health Organization is simultaneously monitoring acute flaccid paralysis and polio. The number of cases that they're saying are polio are very low, you know, a few tens of cases. And they have 100,000 cases of the identical symptoms. And nobody cares because the World Health Organization doesn't think it's infectious. It's probably pesticides or, you know, perhaps pharmaceuticals, other things like that. And they actually, even through their perverse logic, they even believe that the rise in cases of acute flaccid paralysis is a good thing. And that's not because, it's incredible, but it's not because they think the children being paralyzed is a good thing. Their belief is that they haven't been very good at finding cases of paralysis. So they think the background rate of paralysis for reasons other than polio is basically a constant. So if they're finding 100,000 cases now, they believe that in 1996 when they started, there probably were 100,000 cases, but they could only find, you know, 10 or 20% of them. And so they're basically saying if we can find all cases of paralysis in the world, then we know we've got all the polio because the polio is a small percentage. So they convinced themselves that they don't have a problem with an increasing number of children being paralyzed. What they actually have is a success of the World Health Organization's surveillance system. Yourself on the back, because we're doing such a great job. They are incapable of thinking, like, we have a health crisis. We have over 100,000 children around the world being paralyzed. And being paralyzed in a third world country means that you're going to live your life in poverty and you'll probably die young because you'll starve to death.
Right.
If you don't have a family that's willing to look after you, you're not going to survive. So I was talking earlier about, you know, the disease model being part of the problem. I mean, I think what people in the third world need, just like in America, is they need the basic essentials, clean water, nutritious, clean food. You know, by clean, I mean not just washed, but like not contaminated with pesticides. But what they're getting from Western medicine are pharmaceuticals and vaccines. Those are the things. So the West says, if we can make drugs and vaccines cheaper, we have this huge market, you know, a burgeoning middle class, people who are willing to pay for drugs and vaccines, governments that are willing to pay, and if they can't pay, then we'll donate money to them. But we're not dealing with the underlying causes of poverty, which are things like wars, instability, corrupt governments, those kinds of things, which are a lot harder to deal with. Although if we stopped interfering in foreign countries, maybe in some cases things would get better just on their own.
Terrible. Now, in 1977, the World Health Organization instigated a massive campaign in Africa to eradicate smallpox among the urban population. They deliberately inoculated over 100 million Africans with contaminated smallpox vaccine. A year later, 1978, medical practitioners associated with the Centers for Disease Control and the New York Blood Center inoculated over 2,000 white male homosexuals against hepatitis B with a contaminated vaccine. And then you have Merck and Sharp and Dome, who funded the hepatitis B vaccine research. And
some people think that those vaccines were contaminated with a virus called, I believe, SV40. my analysis would be different. We know that there's about 100 reasons that have been documented for a false positive HIV test. And one of those reasons is vaccination, because I believe that the HIV test, the antibody test, is so bad that it's basically just measuring an elevated level of antibodies. And that's why if you get a blood transfusion, you're likely to test positive. If you get vaccinated, there's a much higher probability you will test positive. If you have autoimmune conditions, there's a much higher probability of testing positive on this terrible test known as the HIV antibody test. I think one of the mistakes of people who are critical of allopathic medicine is that they believe that the cause of all these illnesses has to be an infection. That if vaccinations cause disease, it's because there was a virus that wasn't supposed to be there that was in there, or something biological. And I'm saying it's not necessary at all. You can have an adverse reaction to the metallic components of a vaccine. Like, a lot of vaccines have mercury or aluminum. You don't need a virus or, you know, or a reaction to monkey kidney cells or to eggs or something like that to have an adverse reaction. Not that those couldn't cause them. But we need to think about everything that goes into the vaccine. And aluminum is certainly something that I've been educated about in the last couple of years. It's being used more and more in vaccines, and I think it's very dangerous in, for example, the HPV vaccine.
Wow. We have so much aluminum in our environment. People should avoid it at all costs.
Well,
aluminum foil.
Right, but I think what's particularly dangerous about vaccines, like, I'm kind of neutral about how dangerous it is to use aluminum in the kitchen. I personally don't really like using aluminum, but vaccines are injected.
Right. They go right to your bloodstream.
Right. Some people have said, for example, that take mercury, that the amount of mercury in a tuna fish sandwich is greater than what's injected with the flu vaccine. Well, I think if you injected the tuna fish sandwich into your arm, you'd probably die. So that's a completely nonsensical comparison. What's injected gets absorbed into your body at a much, much higher rate, and it avoids all of your body's ability to filter out things that it doesn't like. And one of the points that some of the aluminum experts I've talked to have said is that aluminum is interesting because it's, I think, the third most common element on the planet. And there is not a single biological system that contains aluminum, which means, you know, given that it's so available, you'd think it would be widely, you know, used in biological systems, just like carbon or phosphorus or nitrogen or oxygen. Those are all widely used in organic chemicals that are natural. But aluminum, just like mercury or arsenic, is not used in a single one. And some people say, well, it's in a vaccine. That doesn't mean it's biologically active. But the very purpose of having aluminum in a vaccine is as an adjuvant. It increases the immune reaction. So it is biologically active.
Oh, absolutely.
And according to some of the experts, like Chris Shaw and Chris Exley are two of the aluminum experts I've talked to. I think you can only be an aluminum expert if you have the name Chris. These experts have said that what they think is happening is that the aluminum is kind of an irritant. The white blood cells see the aluminum, they wrap themselves around the aluminum, and that the aluminum is bound to the thing that activates your immune system. The problem with this is that this can get carried across the blood-brain barrier.
Right.
And you can have aluminum in your brain. And since it's metallic, it's electrically active, and that can screw up your brain. And, you know, there's a lot of vaccine side effects are things like paralysis or severe learning disorders, you might call it, things like autism, where your brain is just not working properly.
Right. Well, yeah, the two types of mercury, ethyl mercury is the kind that you ingest. Methyl mercury is what they put in into vaccines.
And no, it's actually thimerosal is ethyl mercury. But some people say, well, ethyl mercury is not as toxic as methyl mercury. But when I have read the literature, it's actually the scientific literature, they're both highly toxic. And it's kind of, not a very good comparison because it's kind of like lead or arsenic. You know, which one should I ingest? Your answer is just either one. So we have, methyl mercury is what was the cause of the Minamata disaster in Japan.
Oh, right.
But ethyl mercury is in thimerosal, and it is also extremely toxic. Metallic mercury is a different thing because, you know, metallic mercury to some extent will go through your body unchanged, but once it gets bound to an ethyl or a methyl, then it is now organic and it will stay within your system. I first learned about metals when I was talking to a man named Mark Purdy, who sadly has passed away, but he was an organic farmer in England who protested against the government's mad cow activities.
Mm-hmm.
He blamed, eventually, it took him many years to get to this point, but he blamed mad cow disease on metals in the brain. He believed that the brain was having the copper, which it needs. You need a certain amount of copper in your brain to have a functioning brain. He thought this was being displaced by other metals. And the reason he thought this was happening, because in England, they had an infestation of flies. I think they were called blowflies.
Oh.
And they drill a hole in the cow's skin and they lay their eggs. Now, the reason why the government was upset about this was not because it was, you know, causing pain for the cows or whatever. It was reducing the value of the cow hide.
Oh.
Well, yes,
yes. All righty. We will be right back in 3 minutes. Welcome back. This is Deanna. And our guest is David R. Crow. He is president of the Alberta Reappraising AIDS Society. That website is aras.ab.ca and rethinkingaids.com. And I'll post those in the chat room. You're right. I misquoted the toxicology of ethyl and methyl mercury.
Yes, no problem. A lot of this is confusing, and I know that allopathic doctors and scientists try to pull the wool over people's eyes,
right,
because they are, you know, better trained in some of the buzzwords, but often they don't understand all of this. I don't know how many MDs are well trained in toxicology. It may come as a surprise to them that, oh, we're using mercury in vaccines, or, oh, there's some drugs that still have arsenic in them. Well, you know, somebody smarter than me must have figured that out.
Yeah.
I was talking about mad cow disease and Mark Purdy.
Right.
I wanted to say that, the British government had to tackle this fly that was reducing the value of the hides of the cows that they were killing for meat. They had a mandatory pesticide program where they took the organophosphate pesticide Fosmet, and it was poured over the skin of the animal, which reduced the infestations of these flies. Mark Purdy was an organic beef farmer, and he said, no, I'm not going to do this. So he got into a big fight with the government. I think he eventually won that fight. But it took him down the road of, you know, what's going on with mad cow disease. And he wrote a book on this, but a couple of things that really struck me is the first case of mad cow disease occurred in a cow and a chicken on the same farm. So now you either have to say, okay, well, it's infectious, but it's going from cows to chickens, which, you know, most people say that diseases tend to stay within the same animal. or it was environmental. For example, perhaps the phosmet, which is poured over the cows, contaminated some of the feed the chicken ate, and the chicken also had this neurological condition. But Mark Purdy eventually concluded that the phosmet was screwing up the metal balance in the brain, and that's it was its mode of action. And he also studied places around the world where people are exposed to toxic metals. For example, there is an Aboriginal village in on an island in Australia, downwind of a major manganese mine, and manganese is another toxic metal. So these Aboriginals are experiencing many neurological conditions, which are very easily explained by the government as, well, there goes another drunk Aboriginal. But that unsteady gait could be neurological poisoning for being close to an open bit manganese mine.
Sure.
And it's beneficial in so many ways for industry to be able to pollute without consequences. And that when people get sick, to be able to produce expensive products that maintain their dependency on the chemical industry. So companies that both produce chemicals and produce drugs have it made, right? They can produce chemicals, people can get sick from being exposed to chemicals, and then they can be sold more chemicals to deal with whatever health problems they end up with.
Wow. Oh, amazing. It is really, really sad what they've done to the to the animal and human population of the world.
Yeah, it is. I think, and often we do it to ourselves. Like if we go back to AIDS, I think the homosexual community back in the 1980s, they had a choice. There were two hypotheses for what was causing AIDS. There was the infectious hypothesis, which meant that the reason why they were getting infected was because they were in this, what they call the fast track lifestyle, gay lifestyle in these inner cities. They were very promiscuous, going to the bathhouses, having thousands of anonymous sexual partners. So that was one possible cause. The second was drugs. And paupers, if you go online and search for paupers, the brand names are basically homoerotic names. It's all the same chemical. They put it in different bottles with different labels, but it's all basically the same chemical, but it's sold as a homoerotic substance. And if you read gay literature or a movie with a gay theme, you will have casual references to paupers. And if you've never heard of them, but if you have some gay friends and you ask a gay man, it's not used by lesbians, you know, or at least not to any great extent. If you ask a gay man what paupers are, they will definitely know. It's still widely used. So they really could say, you know, we have a drug problem or we have a promiscuity problem. And ironically, in this era of gay liberation, they said, okay, we have a promiscuity problem. And now we have to practice safe sex. We can only have sex now. They could have said, you know, we have a drug problem and we need to educate gay men about the drugs that they're taking. It wasn't just paupers, but paupers is kind of almost unique to gay men. So I think they made the wrong choice. There were gay men. John Lauritsen, who is still around, was fighting against paupers. He was a gay man in the New York scene way back then, and he said, paupers are killing us. And he had a few friends who fought with him, but the vast majority just wanted to keep the party going. And it was very easy to sideline, you know, I'm not homosexual, so if I say that the cause of AIDS amongst gay men was drugs, then I'm being homophobic. Well, heterosexuals have a lot of drug problems, as we're now seeing with the opioid crisis.
Oh, definitely.
But each group, you know, whether it's a racial group or a sexual group or gender, the problems that they have, the drugs that they tend to prefer, differ. from country to country, from group to group. That doesn't mean that, you know, taking paupers versus opioids is better or worse. They're both problems. And we need to find ways to live without, you know, vast quantities of synthetic chemicals. The reason why paupers are popular amongst gay men and opioids are popular in the Rust Belt, you know, there's lots of different reasons for that. But we need to just address what it is that causes people to want to drug themselves so much. Like, what's wrong with our society? People feel the need to dull their pain in this way.
Oh, absolutely. I think that's a big question. And the, apparently the FDA just recently approved of a substance that's even worse than opioids. It's more dangerous, more lethal than opioids.
One time not long ago, I was pretty naive, and somebody told me that heroin was a product of the Bayer Corporation. And again, I didn't believe them, so I looked it up, and it was. And the reason why aspirin and heroin sound the same is because they were both produced by Bayer Corporation. And, you know, so this opioid crisis has been with us for a long time. But talking to people who are kind of experts in addiction, I'm not sure that the drug is the biggest problem. I think there are certain people who fall into drugs. And I don't think it's because they're genetically that way, but I think our society is spitting out damaged people psychologically.
Oh, absolutely.
And so we need to look at, like, why is it that some people seek out drugs, whereas other people are resistant? As somebody said, you know, if there was a little container, a little bowl on the table, and somebody said, you know, it's full of ecstasy pills, you know, most people would be horrified and say, I'm not touching that. Right? Right. I don't eat that. But certain people would kill themselves by eating those pills because they just need that numbing.
And wouldn't you say that this is incremental? That this didn't just happen one day, that the family unit, the changing of the family unit, and just the respect for humanity has gone down. And when you destroy the family unit, and particularly in certain populations, I think that certain populations are targeted for drug use, just like with the opium wars in China. That was a biological warfare by England, that they went in, and of course people could have said no, but it was something that you present something as being very good and wonderful and beneficial, just like allopathic medicine is presented, when in fact it's lethal, dangerous, with horrid side effects. But well, the way that something is presented, people will accept it. And if they have any kind of situation where they think they need extra help, you know, they're vulnerable.
Right. I'm not sure it's just the family. I interviewed a guy who was I can't remember his name, but he's like a neuroscientist or something now. But when he was a teenager, he was a severe drug addict. He started with alcohol. His father was a doctor, so he went to the opioids. He went through at least a decade of severe drug use before he came out the other side. But in his description of individuals who were addicts, sort of a feeling of loneliness and separation was something that they all seem to have in common. And, right. And certainly if you have a good family, you shouldn't have that feeling. Not all families are good families. And sometimes I think people feel lonely even though they're surrounded by a family that they just, you know, find horrible. But I do believe that we need to make social connections. And I think some people see the drug as providing the benefits of of social connections. I can't really speak for people who are into drugs, but I think it's a response to loneliness. And it doesn't really matter what the drug is. It's whatever is available.
Certainly. And I view alcohol as a drug. It's certainly addictive and has certainly destroyed many families where you have alcoholism. And it seems to be generational. Yeah. It seems that if your grandfather and your father and your mother or whatever drank, then that is the way that they solve problems. So people do what they see their progenitors doing.
I think so. And also, if you grow up in an alcoholic family, then you're probably growing up in a dysfunctional family, and maybe alcohol becomes your way to escape the alcoholics in the family. I mean, alcohol is interesting because I think, like marijuana, it can be used in moderation by most people, but some people cannot use it in moderation. And I think that was the insight of Alcoholics Anonymous, was that if you're one of those people, you don't have the choice of using alcohol responsibly. You have to stop, because you're one of those people that once you take one drink, you're going to go back again. You know, most people can handle alcohol responsibly most of the time, but it definitely causes far more damage to society than any other drug. Because
it's certainly more car accidents.
Yes.
Can be attributed to alcohol.
Yeah, its damage goes way beyond, you know, just the fact that somebody's
social
and destroys their family. But yes, traffic accidents and many other things that happen under the influence. I mean, when something really, really stupid happens, when somebody does something really stupid, I'm thinking there's a really good chance that they were under the influence of alcohol.
Right.
I mean, how many young men have got hammered and then decided to do something that ends up ruining their life, whether they injure themselves, whether they kill somebody else, whether they rape a woman. A lot of those decisions are made under the influence of vast amounts of alcohol,
right.
Things that they were sober that they would have never done.
Right.
Like, I remember one guy, it's kind of funny, but there was a guy in Australia who decided he was going to wrestle a shark. It was a small shark, but he was very, very drunk, and he managed to get the shark out onto the dock. It's the kind of thing that, like, if you were sober, you would not even think of doing. And it was very funny. Like, it got into the newspapers because, you know, man wrestles shark. It's kind of like man bites dog. But, of course, most of the incidents are not that funny. You know, when somebody drives their car into another car that's full of innocent people, that's not funny.
Right. And sometimes, I don't know, things happen in families, and you can have an addictive personality. Some people are more prone to addiction than others. Would you agree with that or no?
Yeah. And I think it's the circumstances. Like, I'm not gay, so I don't want to psychoanalyze the gay community, but I think it's obvious that, homosexuals have been shunned throughout history. And I think what happened, you know, during the era of gay liberation was that gay men were trying to create family. Now, a lot of gay men, they would just find a partner and they'd go live in the suburbs, and they'd say they were living with their brother or something to cover up, you know, the fact that homosexuality was shunned upon, and they'd live kind of a suburban middle class life and try to keep low profile. But the fast track gay lifestyle, unfortunately, involved the consumption of a lot of drugs. And it was like a party all the time. And when you're 20, you can get away with it for a while. But as time goes on, it starts to catch up with you. You can only consume so many chemicals. It also means that, you know, you haven't made, you know, you're not making true relationships. It's not a commentary on promiscuity, but, you know, there's a big difference between having a partner, somebody you can go home to and cry on their shoulder, whether it's another man or a woman or whatever, you know, somebody who can be emotional support for you. You don't get emotional support at a bathhouse having sex with somebody you don't even know their name. And I think a lot of gay critics commented that this was not a healthy lifestyle psychologically, not so much from the point of view of are there viruses, things like that.
Right. And of course, the promotion with the gay liberation or the gay pride parties or parades or whatever, I think that having it promoted and pushed, I think that whatever you do in the bedroom is really nobody else's business. So I just don't understand why.
Well, I see the gay pride parades differently. I think, it was very difficult for homosexual men and women to go public with their choice.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the gay pride parades are, an indication of that. Some people find it over the top, with the overt sexuality and things, but I don't see that as an unhealthy part of being homosexual. I do see the reliance on drugs as an unhealthy part of any lifestyle. And I want to make it clear that I don't believe that all gay men are drug users, but there was this sort of this core that saw this party lifestyle as liberation. Not only are we now sexually liberated, but we're liberated in every other way and we can use drugs whenever we want and all this kind of stuff. And I think true liberation is maybe different than that. And I think a gay man who said, you know, I'm not going to have a fake marriage with a woman because I'm not attracted to women. I'm actually going to live with a man because that's what I want. I think they maybe found a better way to express their sexuality.
And I, like I said, what people do in the bedroom is certainly up to them. And I don't believe that homosexuality should be promoted in the schools among first graders who are taught about homosexuality. They're far too young to even be thinking about sex education. I think that these things should be taught within the home, not in a public school.
Well, I'm not an expert on sex education curriculums. I do believe that children should be taught about sex education. And I remember when I was in maybe grade 6 or 7 looking up homosexuality in an encyclopedia and discovering that it was also found in animals or something, which I didn't know at that point. I think there are, you know, getting the right age at which certain things are appropriate is important. But I don't think that we should pretend that it doesn't exist. I think children are better off if they know how their body works and they know what sex is and they know about the different choices with sex.
But not in the first grade.
No, I think there's age appropriate stuff.
Right.
And so I don't think the grade ones are ready to know about any kind of sex because they don't really know what it is. It's just something icky that adults do. But certainly I know
my parents never had sex. They only had sex twice.
Yes. Well, I remember falling in love for the first time when I was in grade 6. But it was a non-sexual love. I just thought this girl was the cat's meow. I can't even remember her name. And I would have died for her if she'd ever talked to me, which she probably never did. But obviously, I was starting to develop sexually in a non-sexual way, but to develop romantic feelings.
Sure.
My mother was a biologist, so we had books around the house, and you know, she had a book on, you know, sex and birth and all those things. So I was able to look at the pictures, and I don't know how old I was, but probably 8 or 9 years old. I think where there's a balance, because I think people need to be comfortable with sex as well. And
right.
A lot of society tries to make people uncomfortable.
Right. And I think children should be taught in a healthy way. but I suppose some children grow up thinking it's something dirty, and which it isn't. but...
Well, I mean, most parents instinctively hide their own sexuality from their children. And I think that's a mistake. It's kind of like hiding alcohol from the children. When I grew up in Europe, and I remember going to France, and you know, they serve you a little glass of beer or something, and if there was a celebration, you'd get a glass of champagne, and so you would have a little bit of alcohol, and I think that was, you know, letting you know that you can use alcohol responsibly. I don't remember anybody getting drunk and doing stupid things at those big dinners I had with my parents' French friends. But in England, where I came from, where alcohol is sort of handled differently, binge drinking is now a huge problem. And I wonder if that's because parents say, you know, you're under 18, you will not drink in this house.
Certainly.
At Christmas,
At
Christmas or Easter or whatever, my parents would serve me a little tiny glass of wine, and I thought it was very grown up. It didn't cross my mind that if I kept drinking wine, I could get myself drunk. It took me a few years to understand what would happen if consumed too much.
I think you're talking about binge drinking. I think we're talking about self-control, that when young people go off to college, now it seems that they spent way too much time binge drinking, because now they're not under the auspices of their family. Now they can do whatever they want. And you go to college to get an education, not to binge drink.
Well,
so
I think that's true. I mean,
learning self-control. Right. Self-discipline is important.
I think the sort of overly sheltering parents are not doing their children they're not helping their children. With my three children, I tried to make them as independent as possible. I let them ride their bikes to school. You know, I let them, you know, use sharp knives in the kitchen if they wanted to cook, things like that. I kind of gave them more freedom in a lot of ways. So they have grown up to be very independent children. They have made some bad decisions at times, but nothing terribly bad. But I think there's a lot of parents who shelter their children, and all of a sudden you're in university and you don't have your parents looking over your shoulder. So now sex, drugs, alcohol are the forbidden things that now you can overindulge with.
Right.
And certainly some kids do that. Some grow up, right? After almost flunking their first year, they might, you know, get a big wake up call and go, oh my God, if I keep doing this, I'm not going to graduate. Others just keep going. And, you know, if their parents are rich enough, they can sort of get floated through university. But I think a lot of kids drop out because they make bad decisions, which is just sad.
At college age is not the time to be making bad decisions. As you indicated, you need to learn as you're growing up how to make decisions that are beneficial for you. Not later when it can be so devastating to your life.
Yeah, no, I agree. I was always a big fan of outdoor pursuits as a way to mature. Mm-hmm. And I think, although people criticize things like Boy Scouts a lot, I think that being out in the wilderness, being responsible for yourself, does help you grow up and be more independent. And I know some of the boys that I took out when I had a scout group many years ago, this was their first experience of like choosing their own food for the weekend and cooking it and, you know, their own shelter. They had a lot of responsibilities that they didn't have at home because there was always somebody to look after them.
Right.
Which is relatively new, because I think in the 1800s, you know, there were not too many children who were sheltered up to the age of 18, where they didn't have to have any hard decisions.
Right. Now, somebody in the chat room just posted, I have known a few gays in my life, and they were very unhappy people. I was never sure why. And I think that sometimes things happen to people For instance, if a girl is sexually molested by her father, and for a lengthy period of time, that is certainly going to alter her sexual choices. Okay, we're at a break. We will be right back. We are back. This is Deanna, and our guest has been David Crow, and his websites are ARAS.AB.CA and RethinkingAIDS.com. And I was, so this woman that I knew had been sexually molested by her father over a period of time, and it just totally altered her choices. She was very heavy. She, I think, psychologically made herself unattractive to men. And she was not happy. She really wasn't. She was a wonderful person. Absolutely caring, loving, a wonderful person.
I know a variety of gay men through AIDS, mostly gay men, not too many gay women. And I know some who seem very happy and well-adjusted, but I think a lot of them go through a lot of psychological trauma when they're younger, feeling not accepted, maybe not even accepted by themselves. And I think one of the things that AIDS gives them is if you're diagnosed HIV positive, there's a lot of support for you. You can get housing support. You will have lots of visits with doctors and nurses. You can get to see a psychologist. So you end up with this phony family that is actually feeding off the money that you generate. Because even in America, if you're HIV positive, you don't really pay for too much. It's all covered by the government. But these people sort of become your family. So one of the things I found with gay men who start to question the HIV theory is they realize that they're going to lose this sort of phony family that they have, that they're going to have to stay away from the doctor because the doctor is going to be pushing them to take the drugs. And they don't want to go to the AIDS organizations where everybody's all talking about their drugs and the side effects and all of this kind of stuff. So medicine kind of provides the acceptance that they haven't felt that they've had. And I think this is just as damaging to them psychologically and physically because of the drugs that they're taking as, for example, the party lifestyle. Like I say, I think a lot of gay men have found a balance in their life, whether that means living with a partner or not. But they have a meaning in their life because, of course, our sexuality is not everything in our life. We all have, you know, a well-balanced life has lots of things other than your sexuality. So I think the gay men who have found happiness, just like heterosexuals, have a lot of things in their life. They have friends, maybe they have a fulfilling job, or they do volunteer work, or they have things that keep them going every day, the reasons to get out of bed in the morning and get up, do something productive.
Right. And it's a personal choice, and sometimes they choose because of experience that they've had that has created some damage.
Well, we'll never know, you know, exactly why. I mean, why do people become homosexual? I think that's a question I know it's politically charged, but I really want to have a little bit of humility and say that I really don't know why that happens. It could be their family circumstances. It could be hardwired into them. Lots of different things. I don't know. I think if people are happy with their choices, that's great. And if somebody is terribly unhappy, I mean, it could be because of their sexual choices, or it could be other things in their life, like maybe they never got over their abuse as a child.
Right. Well, thank you so much, David, for being on the program today.
It was a pleasure.
Thank you so much.
Okay,
right.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye, listeners. Talk with you next week. Take care. Have a good week. Bye-bye.